Okay, and joining me now for this very special Rare Disease Day episode of the Bloodstream Podcast is Rebecca Stewart and Nicole Miller, the CEO and editor-in-chief, respectively, of Rare Revolution magazine. Hello to you both and welcome.
Hi, it's great to speak to you.
I appreciate you figuring out the time difference and all the rest as we are speaking from across the pond, so to speak. But that's kind of an interesting place to start in thinking about Rare Disease Day. It is a global day of recognition. Before we get into, you know, personally who you each are and what you're doing, how you started what you're doing, can you just speak to what is the significance of Rare Disease Day?
So I think for us, Rare Disease Day is a really nice opportunity to amplify the voices and the effects of the whole rare disease community. And it does it under a theme that encompasses, you know, a particular challenge or a broad umbrella challenge that's faced by the community. And it's an ideal way for organizations to focus their messaging and otherwise really shine a spotlight on work for organizations that, you know, wouldn't normally otherwise have the capacity and the means to launch a campaign and raise huge amounts of awareness. So it's something that benefits communities of all sizes, but it's just a really nice opportunity to bring everybody together under one common message to say, here we are, this is what we're doing, these are the challenges we face, and here's the help that we need to start achieving some of our goals.
So let's not get too far ahead then. Can you please tell me, what is Rare Revolution magazine and how did the two of you come to start it?
So Rare Revolution magazine was started to be more than just a publication. We wanted this to be a rare disease movement, and the primary aim was to really disrupt the way that rare disease education and signposting is delivered. We wanted this to be much more of a global conversation that really took the genuine voices of the community and gave them an opportunity to be heard. I think the opportunities that existed beforehand were very much, we have the mainstream press and we have information that's siloed in websites and other sort of more scientific publications. And we wanted to do something that really gave a wider benefit to everybody with regards to sharing their information and raising awareness for rare diseases.
Yeah, and I think how it came about really was, I guess, like most people in the rare disease space, we didn't really choose rare disease, it sort of chose us. So my son was diagnosed with an ultra rare disease, xeroderma pigmentosum, when he was 1 year old. And very quickly we realized that life as we knew it was over and we needed to make some big changes. Rebecca and I are sisters, and immediately she kind of rallied and we had a plan and things started happening, and very quickly we formed a rare disease charity for that condition to try and sort of meet the unmet needs and to do some project work that we wanted to do for that particular rare disease.
Would that be the Teddington Trust that you're speaking of?
That's right, yeah. Teddington Trust, that's right. Now, we'd never worked together, we worked in totally different areas, and so it meant us coming together creatively to found this charity, to run this charity, all the while as a family dealing with my son's diagnosis. And then we just actually found that we worked really well together. We found lots of gaps through doing what we were doing, particularly with regard to getting messaging out. So as Rebecca said there, previously people had to rely on mainstream media to get messaging out. And we found with the work we did through Teddington Trust, we would have some amazing campaigns, some really great project work that we wanted to get out there to get support and to raise awareness. And without exception, every time we tried that, we'd have huge big coverage, which was fantastic, but they never focused on the project work, they never focused on the awareness, they always took the personal interest story, kind of tried to turn it into a sob story, which was not how, you know, it didn't resonate with us as a family or as the work of a charity, and turned into something very different from what we wanted it to be. And so really, over the years, we were sort of musing as to, oh, this is so frustrating. How can we get the message out in the tone we want? And in that time, we were connecting with lots of other rare disease charities and finding that they had the same frustrations. And we just kept coming back to this, like, well, where is there that we can do that? And it just didn't exist. And so kind of in a bit of a maverick conversation with somebody, they said, well, if it doesn't exist, why don't you create it? And literally that was the sort of the touch paper. And, you know, from that idea, we went ahead and we launched the website. Well, we did a Facebook page to kind of gauge interest and see whether people felt there was a need for it. And 11 weeks to the day after that, we launched our first magazine. So it was all very, like, the momentum happened very quickly. And we just thought, yeah, this is absolutely what we should do. And it gave us a great opportunity to carry on working together in a slightly different way. We still also run the charity still now. That's sort of how it all came about, really.
And I see here that at some point you gave a TEDx talk as well. At what point did you as an individual start becoming outspoken and something of a prominent advocate as an individual, Nicola?
I guess the minute you hear that diagnosis or the minute you're thrown into that world, you whether you like it or not, you become an advocate, especially when you're doing it on behalf of a child. So my son was 1 year old, so he had no ability to advocate for himself. It was a completely unknown world to us. We were immediately having to talk to people who knew nothing of his condition, so we had to really fast time learn about it. So you become an advocate the minute that day changes your life, really. Through the work that we did with the charity, we started off doing project work, and very quickly we realized there was a lot to do, and we started speaking to other families and realizing that actually things weren't right. People weren't getting the support they needed in schools. They certainly weren't getting the support from social services that were needed. And there were so many battles. So then you start thinking, well, I'm not just kind of mama bear for my son. I want to do it for other people. And then particularly on a global front, we started to realize that it's one thing to live with xeroderma pigmentosum or any rare disease in the UK or in the US, but it's a completely different prognosis once you start looking at places like Zimbabwe or India or different places where perhaps the infrastructure isn't so good and the resources aren't as readily available as they are here. But then we started thinking, well, there's so much to be done on a global scale that really it just kind of went from there, really. But I can honestly say that for me, literally that drive home that day that we were given the diagnosis, I knew that we were going to have to just sort of take it by the horns and advocate, really, and kind of went from there.
There's so much in what you just said, but one of the things that strikes me, as you said, that the diagnosis, right then and there, you know, life has changed forever. And I'm always struck by a rare disease doesn't just affect the patient, it affects the entire family and so many other people. So, Rebecca, for you, what did the diagnosis of xeroderma pigmentosum mean when you first heard of it, and how did that change your life?
Well, I suppose for us, at the time that Edison received his diagnosis, Nicola and I were actually both expecting children. So Nicola was expecting her second and I was expecting my third. And for me, you know, I have three healthy, unaffected children. We all live a very active outdoor lifestyle. This particular condition means that patients cannot be exposed to ultraviolet radiation, so that's all hours of daylight and some artificial lighting. So we could immediately see as a family the huge scale and impact of that condition on Edison, on Nicola, and on the whole family. And we live quite far away, so we're over 600 miles apart here in the UK. And I just thought, I can be no practical assistant, I can't take a dish round, I can't babysit, I can't let them get out for a night, I can't help with childcare so that, you know, Nicola could go back to work. What could I do to ensure that we could support them in whatever the needs were that were going to arise for them as a family? And that was why Teddington Trust was originally formed. It was originally set up as a not-for-profit, really to help look at what the needs they would need as a family. And then as we went through that process, we realized that a lot of the things that we'd put in place and started to develop would be beneficial to the wider community. And that was, you know, when the charity was born. But for me personally, it was a huge drive to be helpful. I really felt like I had to do something to assist, because the impact is so great, you just can't do it on your own. And so really that was my motivation, was just I had to be useful in some way.
Was there ever any fear from either of you or other members of the family that if the magazine and if the foundation were successful, that the disease would really maybe take over everyone's life in a way that you would try to prevent it from otherwise?
That's a really, really good question, actually. And it's something that I am aware of every day, particularly obviously Edison is in my house. So I make a really conscious effort that when I'm working on Teddington Trust activities, so unless it's a particular event that he wants to come to or, you know, something that we're doing that's really fun, in the main, he doesn't see the work that I do. He knows that I run the charity and he knows what it's all about and he's part of the things where he can benefit from it. But I'm very conscious to separate when I'm talking about the trust and when I'm doing work on that, because I don't want him to feel that our whole life is about rare disease. It's just such a small part of who he is as a person. It doesn't in any way define him. And actually it doesn't really, although it may seem because we're so absorbed in it, from our family's point of view, it's really very separate. Up until quite recently, I actually worked from home. So it meant we had a lot of resources and things in the house, but again, we tried to keep it quite separate. So he's involved in as much as he wants to be, but it doesn't really dominate our life. And that's a very, very conscious decision because I just don't want him to feel that that has taken over our life. In fact, he actually said something funny about 6 months ago. He said, we were talking about doing good and being good in your community. He said, I think when I grow up, I'd like to have my own charity. And I said, oh, well, you do realize you've kind of already got your own charity. Do you I? And I thought, oh, that's so lovely that he actually hasn't even associated that that's really about him because he sees it being other people.
Yeah.
Successfully managed to do what I've set out to achieve there. So, I think it's a constant thing that we need to balance out. But I think in the main, it works well. I mean, there's no doubt it's a huge amount of work, especially in the early days of the magazine. So for the first sort of 2 years, it was just the two of us. So it was a huge amount of work. And even though we've extended our team, it's still a huge amount of work. But I guess that's the same with any startup business. Whatever it would be in, we'd be in the same situation. We're very privileged that we do manage to be kind of essentially still stay-at-home mums. We're there at the pickup and drop off at school. It's half-term week for us, our children at the moment, and we're both at home full-time with them, juggling work commitments around it. So we've had the luxury of being able to define our own working hours to suit that. And it's something that as a company, an ethos we've extended to all of our team. So whether it's because they care for someone with a rare disease or whether they have one themselves, we have a fully flexible working directive which allows people to work the hours that suit them around their commitments, and it works really fantastically. So
that's great.
It kind of allows us all still to be best parents we can, but while doing the best we can for the overall movement, really.
Yeah, that sounds very thoughtful, practical, and sustainable, which is, as you mentioned, in the first 2 years, just the two of you, there are things I'm sure that you did that you would never do again. Because in the starting of something, you have to do some things that you would just never again repeat if you could avoid it. I'm curious, Rebecca, maybe from you, what does it mean to be a global rare disease community? And as I say that, I'm cognizant that there are so many different rare diseases, and what it means to have one rare disease is not necessarily the same as the next. To live in one country with one health system and one set of access to treatments is not the same as another. So how do we stay connected as a global rare disease community? What really brings us together, in your opinion?
So I think that the individual differences medically for rare diseases, I think in my experience, are almost never the biggest challenge that family face. And there are many, many shared challenges across rare disease. And that stems from whether it is access to treatments and medicines, whether it is access to coordinated expert care, access to social services or education or meaningful employment. All of these challenges, which are very, very common across all rare diseases, are the things that bind the community together. The amount of learning that exists from one group to another is huge. And one of the barriers we came across when we first had this idea for this multi-condition rare disease publication was, well, if so-and-so's condition's not in it, why will people read it? And that was the reason why we thought people would read it, because the challenges across rare disease are, you know, it's never about the medical, the individual medical problems. And also, even on a medical front, many conditions are so multi-systemic that you can have two completely different diseases but still have symptoms and challenges that even medically can be very similar. So I think it's these sorts of things that connect the community together. And I think on a global front, there's still a lot of work to do. I think we are a global community, but equity is still an issue, and that's both from inside developed countries and also to a much larger extent, bringing in those developing countries and ensuring that those voices and those challenges are being heard.
Nicola, is there anything that you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, I guess, a part of what we do through both Rare Revolution and through Teddington Trust is trying to empower these communities to advocate and act for themselves. So often, for example, we provide resources through Teddington Trust to any patient globally with XP. But what we start to do is, if we find a pattern of more than one patient or a little cluster of patients in a country like we did in Zimbabwe, we sent loads of information. We really worked with the community there to say, actually, look at setting up your own group there. And so we've actually been instrumental in several different support groups for XP throughout the world being set up just by that sort of mechanism of encouraging and empowering and saying, look, we can help you to get you started. We can give you the information so you're not reinventing the wheel, and now you go with that and move it forward. And so that's an important thing that we try in both organizations to share as much as we can. It's why everything we do is open source and free publications and free resources, because we want to get it out to people to empower them to say, well, actually, if that mum sitting at their kitchen table has been able to do this, then why can't I? Or why can't I challenge that and make that better? So everything we do is with a real spirit of empowering and encouraging to make sure that everyone kind of up levels and is doing the best they can, really.
Is there a great story of a Rare Revolution magazine success or some effort to connect people in the way that you were just describing, Nicola, that really is exemplary of what you're trying to accomplish?
The revolutionary community is probably the biggest example of that. So the revolutionaries community, we have a closed community on our social media that is for patients, carers, and patient group workers. And we started that to help facilitate a bit of peer-to-peer support, to help us gauge what were the important messages that we needed to tackle within the publication. What we didn't really anticipate when we started that was the level to which that community would engage with each other and how nurturing that community would be. So this is very much cross-condition community, all shapes and sizes of people in there who, you know, really they can post in a very genuine way. They might post on a day when they're having a really bad day, and immediately the group will send messages of support and love, and people might be looking to reach out and find someone that has their condition in another area or near their community, go to work to try and find the answers for them. And I think on a global scale, that's probably the biggest sort of success story that we have, that was something that we didn't necessarily anticipate working the way, but it's been really, really incredible to see that group grow. And now they will, ahead of an event, they will all say who's going to such and such an event, and if they're local to one another, they might meet up in advance or go for dinner afterwards, and you know, they'll share lifts and accommodation and all sorts of things. So it's been
genuine international friendships and collaborations have been formed through that group, haven't they, which has been lovely. And I remember we got a message from somebody who was part of that community and who is a follower of the magazine, who sent us a message to say that they felt that we were the thread that weaved the community together. And I thought at the time that that was just a really lovely sentiment, and I felt really reflective of where we wanted to be in this space. So it was quite moving to read that from somebody who we didn't know personally, but just someone that was part of the movement through these channels.
Nicola, on a very personal level, how have you benefited from the community that you have helped to, in part, create?
Oh, goodness. We've benefited hugely. So at the very start, as Rebecca mentioned, we initially set up the Teddington Trust to try and rally kind of a community around us to help support us. And actually what happened out of that was that our local community really came together with our family and did a huge fundraising effort to help us build an indoor garden for Edison. And we had literally, during that time, we had people that would just turn up at the door saying, oh, we've heard about what you're doing. Can we come and do a bit of building today? They'd come and lay some bricks, or they'd come and do a bit of weatherboarding, or they'd come with a trailer of stone or something to help us. And actually, really quickly, we managed to build this incredible space for him, which has been absolutely invaluable and has greatly enhanced our life personally. And it was a wonderful thing at the time, not only from the physical sort of asset that we've got out of that for him, but also in that it brought our whole community together to know him, to understand what was going on, so that we could really be kind of accepted, which was an incredible thing. But then being part of this wider XP community obviously is incredible, because we can share, we can get a bit of foresight as to where this condition is going. We can help other people that are on the journey sort of behind us. But also I just think just being feeling that you're not alone, because it's very, very dark and isolating when you first get that diagnosis, and knowing that whether they have the same condition or not, people are going through the same challenges is really, really uplifting and helps you get through some of those earlier phases. So it's it's personally, it's been very fulfilling for us.
And so, Rebecca, tell us, where is Rare Revolution magazine headed in 2020? What do you have coming up that our listeners may be interested to know? And in general, for our listeners, most of whom are affected by a rare disease, where should they go to learn more about what you're doing?
Question. So this year, one of our focuses is to start to work on highlighting the challenges in other countries. When we first launched the magazine, although it's digital, we didn't anticipate the speed at which it would grow internationally. And our US audience is phenomenal. It varies from issue to issue, but it's almost the same size as our UK audience, which is incredible. And we are starting to see readers in other countries, but I think we need to be better at really drilling in and focusing on some of those challenges that may differ from country to country, especially in some of these developing nations where things are not as straightforward from a term of infrastructure and healthcare. So more of a focus on international content, I think, this year for us. Potentially we're working on a number of special issues. So we're a quarterly publication, but we would like to do some really drill down focused issues. So that's something that we're doing. We have a very special issue coming out for Rare Disease Day, and another one planned for later in the year, which are very, very specific feature sort of mini magazines, if you like, which are really there to drill down and give some very, very specifics in a particular area or condition group. So that's another area that we're looking to do a bit more of this year.
And just before we wrap up, is there anything else that you would want to make sure our listeners know?
I would say to visit our website, and if they don't already, subscribe and make sure that they read, and also that they share it, because it's important to us that this isn't just about people in the community accessing it. We actually want this to get out into the mainstream general population, so that they can also learn about what the work is and help empower those charities that are sharing their messages. So, the more that we can get the messages that are in the magazine out there, the better. So read it, share it, follow it.
To reach out as well. We're approachable, we're here, we want to share your story. So don't be afraid to drop us an email or pick up the phone and talk to us about you know, how we can support your messaging and support your organizations, I think.
Rare Revolution Magazine, a digital magazine giving a voice to patients affected by rare conditions and the charities that represent and support them. CEO Rebecca Stewart, Editor-in-Chief Nicola Miller, thank you very much for joining us for this special Rare Disease Day episode of the Bloodstream podcast and for introducing, I hope, some more people to Rare Revolution Magazine and the really important work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Take care. Talk again soon. Thanks again to Nicola and Rebecca for joining us at rarerevolutionmagazine.com to learn more. Make sure that you are subscribed to the Bloodstream podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you like to listen. Be sure to check out as well Cheat Codes, a sickle cell podcast, Bloodstream Journeys, Ask the Expert, and all that we have going on at Bloodstream Media, bloodstreammedia.com. And we will be back with another episode very soon. Thanks again for listening, and take self-care of yourself.